Hello friends, my name is Jeremy McCandless and welcome to the Bible Project Daily Podcast. And the project is to transform lives by choosing to work together and study the entire Bible chapter by chapter, verse by verse. You are very welcome whether you're here for the very first time or whether you've been along with us for a couple of years now, nearly 500 episodes in fact. Now you have a choice to make. You can carry on listening day by day, or you can make the decision if you're here for the first time to go right back to the beginning and just work through the entire series at the pace that suits you, which of course is the prerogative of everybody listening to this. New episodes are posted every day, Monday to Friday, with sometimes a compilation episode at the weekend. So if you haven't done yet, just click on that subscribe button wherever you're getting your podcasts from and you'll never miss another single episode. What we'll do now is we'll drop back in the text where we dropped off last time, but do hang around at the end and I'll just update you and give you a little more information. But having said that, it's bye for now. Okay, friends, another new section today. We're going to pick up at Matthew 16, verse 13 to 20. This is a very famous passage of Jesus where Jesus is seen to ask his disciples that absolutely vital question, which is, who do you say I am? Okay, so let's look at the text and see if there's any sort of a discovery or insight that is gained by any of the disciples here. So picking up verse 13, it tells us, when Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asks his disciples, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? So they said, some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the other prophets. But he said to them, this is Jesus talking, but who do you say I am? Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So here we have the story again, picking up at a point where Jesus, in a sense, has made yet another withdrawal from the wider society, or certainly removed himself out of the place he'd previously been. Now, what's worth noting here is that this is the beginning, if you like, of the end of Jesus' ministry. You can see the sort of horizon of the end of this aspect of his teaching and miraculous ministry beginning to draw near. And it would seem that Jesus, again, he really needed and wanted to spend time alone with his disciples. And this was a way he was able to do it. He still had an awful lot to say to them, and certainly a lot to still teach them. And this is because, as we shall find, and we have found all along, that there were some things they just did not seem able to hear or did not want to hear. And there were some things that some of them just did not seem to understand, not yet anyway. So to that end, he is seen here to withdraw to the district of what's called Caesarea Philippi. Now Caesarea Philippi lay about 25 miles northeast of the Sea of Galilee. It's important to note that it was outside the authority of Herod Antipas. Now, he was the guy who was ruler of Galilee at that time and the one who had ordered the beheading of John the Baptist. They're still within the area of control of Philip the Tetrarch, but the population in this area was mainly non-Jewish. Some Bible experts say they believed Jesus withdrew to this area because he would probably have more time and peace, time to teach the 12 who were still following him. The key guys, as it were, these 12 apostles. You see, we're getting to the point where the days of his incarnation, of him being in the flesh, they were numbered. And there was a problem, in a sense, that not even his closest disciples fully understood who he was and what this meant yet. In fact, it would be reasonable to ask the question, was there really anyone yet who fully understood him for who and what he was? And if that's the case, this was a crucial problem, for it involved the very survival of the Christian faith and the message of God given and outworked through him and its survival after he'd gone. if there were none amongst this inner group who had grasped the truth, or even were on the way to grasping it, then all the work that had been done so far could be undone. All he needed was a few core people to realize the truth, and he would know that the work of God and the plan of God was safe. So Jesus was determined to put his followers in these verses to a test, if you like, and ask them and try and find out who they really believed him to be. He had had multiple evidence as he went along the way that they hadn't fully got it yet. They were growing in their faith and their insight, but they weren't quite there yet. Experts believe it is of great significance to recognize the significance of not just the question that Jesus chose to ask, but also why he chose to ask it in this district. You see, there would be few districts that would have more religious associations than Caesarea Philippi. This area was scattered with temples, mainly of the ancient Syrian god Baal, the place where Baal worship would have been carried out, an appalling type of worship that involved the sacrifice of children at Asherah poles. And in this area, there were no fewer than 14 temples dedicated solely to the worship of Baal. And they were based particularly in the area that Jesus is in. This is an area where the culture of these ancient, awful pagan religions still held sway and were rife. It would have been seeped into the very atmosphere and culture of that time. They would be literally standing in the shadow of the temples and the statues of various ancient gods, including Baal. But not only the Syrian gods were worshipped there. Caesarea Philippi was built upon a large hill, and at the base of the hill there was a cave with a deep cavern in it, and that cavern was said to be the birthplace of the Greek god Pan. So there was much going on here with Caesarea Philippi, and it was identified as not only the place of worship of these pagan gods, but also as the original place in which Pan came from. Its original name was actually Panus before it was changed to Caesarea Philippi. And to this day, this place is now, we call the town there today, Banus, which is a reference back to the name Panus, the name that was given as the birthplace of Pan. But the legend of Pan also suggested that that place, that cave with the lake in it, was the source of the River Jordan. It's where it came to life. But there's even more to it than that. In Caesarea Philippi, at that time, when Jesus and the disciples visited, there was a great temple of white marble, and it was built to Caesar in his position as a god. This place was remarkably important to the Roman religious system. It is there they erected this temple, which was dedicated to Caesar. In fact, Roman historian Josephus, writing about this area, describes the temple as being huge, built of white marble, with matching fountains down to the River Jordan. The place it is situated, he said, and identified it as Panaim. He says, where there is a top of a mountain of immense height, and inside it and beneath, a dark cave opens itself within, and within that cave there is a horrible precipice, I'm quoting his words now, that descends abruptly to a vast depth. It contains a mighty quantity of water, which is immovable, and when anyone has tried to let themselves down, or let anything down to measure the depth of the earth beneath the water, no length of cord has been found sufficient to reach it. So that's quoting from Josephus talking about this area. So although originally called Panus and the birthplace of Pan by those who followed Greek gods, later we see Herod's son Philip come along and in his way try and beautify and enrich the whole temple area. And it was he who changed the name of the town from Panus to Caesarea, which means Caesar's town, named after the temple. But then he added his own name, Philippi, at the end to sort of try and get a bit of glory by association. No one who would come to and visit Caesarea Philippi, or even just look at it from a distance, would not see it as this town of pagan worship and the worship of the Roman gods, if nothing else for the massive glistening marble temple on the top of the hill. No one in Jesus' day would think anything else, that this was a town dedicated to the divinity of Rome. Yet it is into this situation and this background that a young, effectively penniless rabbi teacher appears with his 12 very ordinary followers. Now remember, at this very same moment, the religious hierarchy, the Jewish religious hierarchy, are plotting and planning to destroy him, as they would describe him as an alleged heretic, one who's doing what he's doing by the power of Beelzebub. And here he goes, and they're standing in an area that's littered with temples to the Syrian gods, in a place where the ancient gods were said to look down, and in a place where the history of Israel crowded in as well, because it had been recognized as the source of the River Jordan. And yet all the while, this huge white marble temple built to Caesar worship. And all of that is dominating the town and the landscape around him. And it is in this place that Jesus now stands. And he asks his disciples, again, using the situation around him, he says, look at all this. Who do you think I am? Who do you think the people believe I am? And he's actually asking him, do they recognize that he is the Messiah, the Son of God, the Son of the one true God, Most High? As Greek historian William Barclay wrote, it is as if Jesus deliberately set himself against the background of all the world religions at that time and throughout all history, and he put himself in a place of their highest splendor, and he demanded that his followers compare themselves to him and ask them to give a verdict in his favor. Some have said that there are few examples of where Jesus's awareness of his own importance, his own deity in fact, shines out more clearly than it does here when he asks those who are following him to make a decision about him. And by nature, I believe, as disciples or as anybody who follows him and reads the text today, he is also demanding of us to make that decision also. So it is here, in this place, at Caesarea Philippi, that Jesus demands a verdict from his followers. He must know where they stand, and he must know that before he sets out towards Jerusalem, because he knows he's heading towards the cross. And if they've really, or at least some of them have really grasped who he is and what's going on, then he knows the work and plans of God are safely delivered. Yet, also, notice he doesn't ask the question directly, does he? He leads up to it. He begins by asking his disciples what the people, what the crowds were saying about him and who they took him to be. And he gets various answers, doesn't he? Some say that, well, the crowd said he was John the Baptist, which is worth noting that Herod Antipas was not the only man who felt that John the Baptist had come back from the dead. Others say that he was Elijah. Now, in saying that, in doing that, they were saying two things about Jesus. First, they were saying that he was as great as the greatest of all the prophets, for Elijah had always been looked on as the high point of the prophetic line in the minds of the Jewish people at that time. So they were at least acknowledging Jesus as at least the forerunner of the Messiah. As Malachi said in the close of the Old Testament, he talked about the promise of God and said, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes." That's Malachi 4 verse 5. And to this day, in fact, the Jews expect the return of Elijah before the becoming of the Messiah. And even today, they leave a chair vacant for Elijah at the table whenever a family celebrate the Passover, because they know that when Elijah comes, the Messiah will not be far behind. So it would seem that some of the people looked on Jesus and they saw him, if not as the Messiah themselves, as the herald of the Messiah and as the forerunner of the direct intervention of God, but clearly not seeing him yet as the actual Messiah himself. Jesus' disciples also said that some of them appeared to say that Jesus was Jeremiah. Now that's a little bit trickier to unpack, because Jeremiah had a rather curious place in the expectations of the people of Israel at that time. It was believed and recorded in the Jewish apocryphal writings, the extra biblical texts, the texts that didn't make it into the canon of scripture, but there were still writings that said that before the people went into exile, Jeremiah had taken the ark and the altar and the incense out of the temple, and he'd hidden them in a lonely cave in Mount Nebo. And that before the coming of the Messiah, that Jeremiah would return and produce these items again, enabling the glory of God to come back to the people again. And Jeremiah was therefore seen as a forerunner of the coming of the Messiah, and, in a sense, someone coming in a country's time of help and trouble. So when these people in the crowds were identifying Jesus with Elijah and with Jeremiah, they were, according to their thinking, in fact paying him a compliment and setting him in a high place, for Jeremiah and Elijah were indeed recognized as the expected forerunners of the Anointed One of God. When they arrived, they believed that meant the kingdom of God was near indeed. Maybe not at hand, but certainly getting near. So having heard from his disciples what they said the crowd believed who they thought he was, then he turns to the disciples themselves and asks that all-important question, "And who do you say I am?" And it is Peter who is seen to speak up first and make his famous great declaration. He says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Now, hearing this, I believe that Jesus would have known that indeed his work was safe, because there was at least one of his group who fully understood who he was. As an aside, it's interesting to note that in each of the three Gospels, it has its own slight variation of the version of Peter replying to this question. Matthew has him saying, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Mark simply says, and everything Mark says is very stripped down and simple, he just simply says, "You are the Christ." And Luke sort of sits in the middle and says, "You are the Christ of God." Jesus knew by this answer now at least someone amongst his followers now fully recognized him as the Messiah, the Anointed One of God, the Son of the living God. Now, this word Messiah and this word Christ, used in these various accounts of Peter's reply, they actually mean the same thing. One is just Hebrew and the other is Greek, and the terms just mean the Anointed One. Kings were ordained to office by anointing in those days. Well, in fact, they still are. Okay, we shall see that, in fact, and that's what will happen to King Charles here in the UK in May 2023, when he is anointed at a crowning ceremony at Westminster Abbey in May of this year. But here it's saying this is the Messiah, the Christ, the Anointed One. But of course, for Jesus, he's not being anointed just as an authority over a region or a town or even a country. He's being anointed as God's King over all men and women on earth. Essentially, Peter has discovered and is expressing something here that everyone who ever wonders who Jesus is needs to grasp hold of and make a decision about. And that is, he recognizes, first of all, that these human categories, even though they are respectful and they are the highest in effect that people in worldly terms could think of, they are inadequate descriptions of who Jesus Christ really is. You see, when the people described Jesus as Elijah or Jeremiah or one of the prophets, they thought they were probably putting him in the highest category they can think of. Remember way back when we did the overview of Malachi back in season one of this podcast adventure? We did it as a sort of an introduction. We did each of the books of the Bible in about 6 minutes to do an introduction to the whole project. During the time we looked at Malachi, we discovered that it was the belief of the Jews at that time that since the close of Malachi, in other words, for over 400 years, the voice of prophecy had been silent. So these people were in fact saying that Jesus had come to the people, and once again through him they could hear the direct, authentic voice of God for the first time in nearly half a millennium. So these were great tributes in an earthly way, but they were still not good enough or great enough to describe who Jesus actually was. And Peter discovered here that there was in fact no human categorization which you could apply to Jesus to adequately describe who Jesus Christ really was. It's also interesting to note that most people who approach this would point out the fact that Peter, because of his background, remember he was just an ordinary fisherman, he could never have given a theological account or a philosophical explanation of what he meant when he said and declared that Jesus was the Son of the living God. But the one thing with which Peter was certain of, that he had understood that there was no merely human description that was adequate in order to describe him. You couldn't compare him or put him in a line of ordinary mortal men or women. And this passage here, and Peter in his response, reminds me that our discovery, or anyone's discovery of Jesus Christ, must always be a personal discovery. Salvation does not lie within the organization or the religion. It lies in recognizing and discovering who Jesus is for yourself. Jesus' question, the question he asked, is a personal one. Who do you think I am? He said. Do you remember? Maybe you're aware later. Pilate will ask him the same thing. He'll ask him if he's king of the Jews. And Jesus' answer was, who do you say I am? Or are you just repeating what you have heard others say about me? That's in John chapter 18. Our answer to that question, our acknowledgement of who we think Jesus might be, must never be a second-hand verdict. Someone might have studied the Bible for years. They might know every thought and every verdict passed on Jesus. They might even know every theological argument about him and know all about the great minds of history and what they've come up with. They might even be able to give a competent summary of Jesus' teachings or about what every great Christian thinker and theologian has said about him. They can know all those things, but they still might not be a Christian. Christianity never consists of just knowing things about Jesus. It always consists of first knowing him. Jesus Christ demands a personal response, a personal verdict to who you say he is. And it appears to me that if you look at this passage closely and consider the way it's worded, he not only asks this question on that day of Peter, but if you read it closely, I believe he asks it to every one of his disciples. Everyone who says or strives to be a follower of him, he asks that very profound question to which we must have an answer, which is, who do you say I am? Okay, friends, that's it for today. We'll pick up at verse 17 tomorrow. I do hope you're finding that helpful. This podcast is hosted on thebibleproject.buzzsprout.com, and there you will find lots of links to ways in which you can connect and even support this ministry. Most people, most of you, I'm sure, are getting it in other places like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all of that. That's great. But if you're not seeing active links to ways in which you can, for example, see the transcript of what I've said or see the places where I host the other teaching and free resources I make available, then just copy the Buzzsprout address into your browser. And if you click through to there, you'll certainly find links to all the ways in which you can find all the various teaching courses and talks and even videos that I make available in other places. The vision of this podcast is to make this material free to listen to and copyright free in the public domain for you to use and to spread as much as you'd like to. If you are finding this teaching helpful, then why not think about liking it or sharing it with others on any of those social media places that you live on and operate on, because that's the way more and more people will be given the opportunity to see this, find this, and give even the opportunity to respond to that question of who do you say I am, as Jesus asked today, and the opportunity to make a decision to actually make the study of the Bible part of the rhythm of their daily lives from here on in. And we can just rely on that and the work of the Holy Spirit through the reading and the study of that to do his work through it. And we don't need to worry about the rest. So friends, that's it for today. Thank you so much for joining me. I do trust I'll see you back here tomorrow, right back here on the Bible Project Daily Podcast. Bye-bye for now.